the Rage with John Bowd. www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome again to another edition of All the Rage. These are, as we know, continuing to be difficult times around the world. And for whatever it's worth, we always like to extend our love and our solidarity to everyone who's struggling through these difficult times. However, we're going to begin this week's show with a little bit of good news, I think I'm pretty confident in saying, because once again, we're going to be speaking with our Latin American correspondent, Francisco Dominguez, and he's going to be telling us about a few elections. So where should we begin, Francisco? Should we begin in, let's try Bolivia. What happened there last week?
Oh, hello, everyone. Thanks for having me again. In Bolivia, there had been a coup d'etat in October 2019, and ever since there had been a de facto government, which is extremely repressive, nasty, racist, and everything else you can imagine. And it was run by the very small 1-3% white oligarchy minority against virtually everybody else. And you know, Bolivia is a country that has 65% of its population being indigenous. And the racism of the government was so horrible. There were a couple of massacres. More than 30 people died as a result of those massacres. And something like hundreds, possibly more than 800 people seriously injured. Plus, they nearly destroyed the economy in almost 6 months by privatizing everything, closing down everything, making redundant everything, and not dealing with the pandemic, which is typical of right-wing governments in Latin America and elsewhere, being totally incompetent about it. And when they began to respond to the pandemic and they began to, you know, purchase inputs, health inputs from the world economy, the levels of corruption were unbelievable. So much so that even this very government had to actually arrest and dismiss some of their own ministers because they were taking advantage in a very, very multimillionaire fashion of the purchases. Just one example. I mean, there's plenty, but I'll just give you one example for people to have a flavor of what I'm talking about. One minister, the Minister of Health, one of the Ministers of Health, purchased, ventilators, which are very important during the pandemic, especially for grave cases of people infected. And he purchased them at something like $9,000 each. And he invoiced the government $27,000 each. And nobody knows exactly where the money is. That gives you an idea of the kind of government that this was. And the levels of repression and persecution of social movement, trade unions, indigenous organizations, political parties, particularly on the left, especially the MAS, the MAS, which is the Movement Towards Socialism. MAS is the Spanish acronym for it. And they tried to legalize it. And it was extremely difficult. And I remember discussing with yourself and perhaps other people about the strategy adopted by the MAS to deal with it. And they wanted election. They wanted election. They wanted election. And they insisted on elections and elections and so on. I thought, I'm not sure this is going to work because, you know, they, the right wing, were in charge of all the key state institutions, starting from the police, the army, the judiciary, and even, you know, there was a fear that they could also control the electoral tribunal or the Electoral National Council. So I thought, maybe the MAS is going for it, but this is not going to pay off if they rig the election, which clearly they wanted to. As it turned out, which was a sort of pleasant shock for me, I'm sure, but most people, they must actually won hands down. I mean, won by, even under those conditions, they won by 55% of the vote. It was an absolute majority. And, you know, you can imagine this was extraordinary, but there is more, which is also even, as they say in London, even better. they want an absolute majority in Congress. They got, the mass got 78 MPs in a total of MPs in the chamber of 130. So even if all the other parties were to coalesce together to try to oppose any proposal by the new government, they're not going to be able to do it because they got, you know, absolute majority. And in the Senate, they also have an absolute majority, and the situation is exactly the same. Even if the other parties were to coalesce together to oppose whatever proposal the government were to make, then they wouldn't be able to stop it. So this is very interesting. And one interesting manifestation of the defeat of the right is the following. Jeanine Agnès, who was the de facto president, who actually presided over all of these atrocities and more that I didn't have time to tell you, she has been reported in the last 2 days as having requested 350 visas for people to travel to the United States. That gives you an idea that they are already in panic. What is interesting is the person who won the election, Luis Arce, or Lucho Arce as it's more popularly known, he was the Minister of Economics under, you know, President Evo Morales. And Bolivia grew at a rate of something like 5% on average for the last 7 to 8 years. Poverty was halved more dramatically, quite dramatically in those about 10 years. And more than that, you know, extreme poverty was nearly reduced to single digits figures. The country was a building site. The level of income of the population increased so much compared, you know, relatively speaking, compared to what they were before. It's extraordinary. The right wing managed to pull off a coup d'etat and, you know, nearly destroyed the economy. So the economy now and the state is going to be in very safe hands because he, Lucho Arce, was the architect of what people refer to as an economic miracle. And this is feeding through the whole system, the whole of Latin America, which I'm going to comment in a minute, quite nicely. There are two other important pieces of information to give. Number one, Bolivia has 9 departments. It's quite difficult because within departments, there are, you know, smaller political, administrative, distinct divisions within the country. Divisions in the sense, in the administrative sense, district, that sort of thing. And every department will have provinces. So in most other countries, departments will be provinces. And Bolivia has 9 of them. And the right wing was very strong in the east of the country, traditionally in the past. It has always been very strong. And under these conditions, the MAS performed the following feat. The MAS won in 8 departments. In La Paz, the MAS won by 68%. And in Cochabamba, which is an extremely important department, the MAS won by 63%. And in Santa Cruz, which is the only place where the right wing actually won, the right wing won with 45% and the MAS got 36%. That is to say, the electoral performance of the MAS in the country as a whole was extremely powerful. So much so, and this was another shock for me, another pleasant shock, that the government, the Lucho Arce, who won the election, was congratulated publicly by none other than Mike Pompeo, saying that he was delighted and he was quite prepared to work with the government, you know, to resolve all the issues and so on. What's interesting about this is this. The United States managed to have an ambassador only because Jeanine Agnès allowed an ambassador from the United States to come into the country and allowed an embassy to operate. Whereas under Evo Morales, all the U.S. ambassadors were expelled. the, you know, Evo Morales expelled the U.S. ambassador, expelled all the military presence of the United States, expelled the Peace Corps, expelled the Drug Enforcement Administration, and expelled the CIA, literally one after another, because they were interfering, you know, very malignly in the internal affairs of the country. So I'm not sure what Lucho Arce is going to do with the United States, but the very fact that Mike Pompeo at once appears so friendly is an indication of how robust the electoral victory was. The issue is this. Now, this seems to be this victory, which is so robust and there's so difficult conditions, you know, that the movement, the people, the mass, and everybody face, is so robust that actually has sent a sort of wave of optimism throughout the region. In other words, you know, people are thinking, Jesus Christ, it can be done. No matter how difficult it is, if you go for election and you have international observers, which are, you know, huge number of them, which was the case in Bolivia, and you mobilize all sorts of international forces such as the United Nations and what have you, given that there are interesting allies in the region of good things, such as the government of Mexico, the government of Argentina, and a few others in the region, not too many, but, you know, sufficient enough to exert significant pressure, then it can be done. So now this wave of optimism, as it is inspiring and stimulating, you know, people in, certainly in Chile, that has, and plus beside today, against their neoliberal constitution, people in Brazil I've been talking to at various levels tell me, my God, this is excellent. You know, this is going to certainly encourage us to go for elections in 2022, when national elections take place over there. And certainly in February 2021, there will be national elections in Ecuador, where there is a right-wing government which is nearly destroyed. Also, the country has been extremely repressive against the people and the indigenous movement over there. And certainly, this is going to inspire, you know, people in Venezuela that have elections on the 6th of December. So there is a massive amount of optimism, and people feel, you know, this is excellent, it can be done. So maybe this will be an inauguration of a new pink tide, perhaps this time red tide, of progressive governments that are going to start coming up in the region, which is excellent. I'm delighted.
I just want to ask you a couple of questions before we move on this one, sort of both concerning the coup and what happened during that period, maybe a couple of things going forward. So first of all, I was going to ask you, I don't know if you want to add anything to this, but I think you did quite well in your intro there to talk about, I was going to ask you why the coup failed. As I say, I think you just said quite a bit there already about the fact that their mass government were better with the economy, for one thing. They were better with, they had far greater base. More importantly, I think they had, the part I always like to underline is you have a far more switched on population that have greater involvement within trade unionism, for instance. So they were capable of effectively threatening a genuine general strike that could have completely crippled the country.
There are, I think, two things, and, you know, politicians and leaders on the left in the whole of Latin America are discussing this, because, you know, there have been so many setbacks, and they want to learn the lessons, and they are observing, watching, and investigating Bolivia very closely to see exactly what happened. I think there are a couple of reasons. Number one, the movement towards socialism, Movimiento Socialismo, is a very well-connected political party with grassroots organizations throughout the country. There are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of organizations of every imaginable kind. In fact, the MAS is a very peculiar political party. It's not a normal political party. Is a movement of movements. That is to say, is a movement that includes all the existing movements that have emerged in the country over the last, I suppose, 30, 40 years, from different indigenous organizations, women's organizations, people of African descent, trade unions, of course, peasant organizations, small merchants, small traders, you know, particularly in La Paz and in the main cities. They're all organized in different bodies, and all of them converge in the movement of movements, in the mass. Yeah, so the political leadership, the mass, never lost touch with this movement. And when it began to mobilize, first of all, they, you know, obviously retreated tactically, then they regrouped, and then they began to organize demonstrations, carefully calculating their demonstrations to ensure that there was no perception by the people in power, and certainly that the media could use to justify a very horrible, nasty response producing more massacres. They calculated this extremely well. Constantly, I remember watching, you know, as I was following developments in Bolivia, the leadership were saying, we want to mobilize, but please make sure that you do not go all the way to an ultimate confrontation, because they'll use it against us. And it paid off. I mean, they were, this, how can I put it, undermining slowly, carefully, not only reorganizing themselves, but, you know, presenting a bigger and bigger challenge, not allowing the government to actually go for something quite dramatic. And it seems to me that war of attrition, which was very carefully orchestrated by the mass, paid off because they had the connection with the movement. They were able to guide, you know, feed themselves from the movement and so on. And it was very interesting to say, it's very interesting to listen to a discussion by Gleisi Hoffmann of the Workers' Party in Brazil that talked about, was asked about Bolivia, and she said, you know, we should learn from that. In the case of the Workers' Party in Brazil, we somehow, by being in government so long, forgot that we had to have that connection with the movement. And it's quite crucial to have it. And we are, she said, reconnecting in Brazil itself. And thank God we have recovered very quickly. But, you know, there is plenty of room for improvement. And Bolivia shows the way. That's one very important dimension. That is to say, when, you know, they maintained the unity of the movement, there were significant discussions, of course, in the mass, but never to the point of, you know, producing splits or desperation or demoralization. They organized extremely well. That's number one. Number two, when the results on the Sunday the 18th, which was the elections, you know, suddenly the information that the Electoral Council was supposed to be producing suddenly stopped for about 3 hours. And nobody knew what was going on. Everybody imagined this is the coup. They were waiting for it. They were organizing. Apparently, during these 3 hours, I got information which has transpired, you know, in the media and some newspapers in Bolivia. The Añez government, in an emergency meeting of the cabinet, called on the armed forces to the meeting. The generals, I don't know exactly how many, and I don't know exactly the details, came to the meeting, and the government put to them that they needed to actually wage a coup, you know, a coup within the coup, to not recognize the results. And the military apparently said, we are not going to be part of any of this. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there is a guarantee that the armed forces are going to behave, but at that crucial moment, the armed forces that participate in the first coup, they did not participate in the second. And there is quite an important dimension to this, which I forgot to mention, which I want to say now, if I may.
Sure, go for it.
And is this. Luis Almagro, the General Secretary of the Organization of American States, I have difficulty not to use expletives here.
Oh, you can listen, you can use any expletives you want to. We get away with that shit all the time on this show. Yeah.
He is a real nasty bastard. He was totally instrumental in the first coup d'etat. He was asked by the Evo Morales government to come to, you know, observe the elections in 2019. And the agreement was that once the Electoral Council were to give the final information with the full results coming in, Only then the organization American State, the center team there, led by Luis Almagro, was going to actually say their view, they were going to pass judgment on what they thought about it. What they did instead, the results were supposed to come in by Tuesday or Wednesday, and on Monday, the organization American States, under the direction of Luis Almagro, went public and basically said there had been fraud. And they use a very manipulative way of, you know, dealing with the figures, which has been actually demonstrated by Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and even has been proved by the Washington Post and the New York Times that those figures were false, were manipulated, and it was not true. There had been any fraud whatsoever. So as a consequence of what Mr. Almagro has done, then there was the coup. People have suffered enormously. The country has been divided. People have died. You know, there have been horror, and people have suffered as a consequence of the pandemic because of what he facilitated with this, which in my view and in everybody's view was deliberate. So this is what is going to happen now. Number one, Mexico officially has requested that he resign. And they made representations officially to the organization American State, which is extraordinary. The Grupo de Puebla, the Puebla Group, which is an outfit, you know, progressive outfit set up by Mexico, the Mexican government and the Argentinian government, plus, you know, a huge number of very progressive figures, such as former president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, former president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, former president of Paraguay, Fernando Lugo, former president of Brazil, former presidents of Brazil, Lula and Dilma Rousseff, and many more. It's a huge, huge outfit. Also demanded that he resign. On top of that, the Sao Paulo Forum, which organizes all of the political parties of the left, including the Workers' Party of Brazil, you know, the FSLN in Nicaragua, and the Peronistas in Argentina, many, many, many more. In other words, another very influential institution has also demanded publicly that he resign. And there is a number of voices that are joining in to actually to get this bastard out of the way. He's been totally quiet. And very cynically, you know, in the last few days, after a couple of days after the election results, he knows that he has his hands full of blood. Bolivian blood. He sort of congratulated the, you know, the quality of the electoral process and the result, and congratulated the Bolivian people and so on. And I think it's extremely important. I don't, you know, the organization American State is not in my good books. Nevertheless, to actually get this individual, this criminal, out of the way will do a huge amount of good to the whole region, because what it means is if he gets out of the way, you know, if we've managed to force him to sign, we are signing petitions so that he goes, then it's going to be very difficult for multilateral organizations led by the United States, because they were behind the whole thing, to actually be used against, you know, other electoral process and other democratic governments in the region. This is extremely important that he gets out of the way. He should resign if he has any ounce of decency in himself, which I know he doesn't. So he's got to be pushed.
Mm. Yeah, and if listeners want a little more detail on some of the things that went down during this coup period, you can refer to the show we did last week with Claudia Tebedloff, who's a good friend of the show. She came on to talk about some of the grisly but very necessary to hear details. I just want to talk now a little bit about the denial of this being a coup. Now, we no doubt, I'm sure, saw that in Bolivia and other parts of Latin America, but specifically let's concentrate on America and Britain, where the majority of us sitting here will get most of our news from. There was a very concerted effort throughout the whole period as of last year to deny that this was a coup taking place. As you said, the there was no fraud whatsoever. That was just a straight up lie. Nevertheless, Evo Morales said that he conceded to say, well, we'll do the election again if you want to. I'm happy to do that with international observers. That wasn't considered good enough. He was, to all intents and purposes, exiled for a period of time and still banned from being able to stand, which was, I know there's some disagreement about exactly how this the constitution works or has become working in Bolivia. Nevertheless, it was constitutional that he could re-stand. All of these things took place, not to mention bloodshed and repression and very, very strong attempts to try and stop the election from taking place even in the first place. So the people who tried to deny this was a coup now, and, you know, by rights, we probably shouldn't even bother paying attention to them. But nevertheless, as I often talk about on this show, you can't really ignore people who have power, whether you like them or not. And that's the issue. It's always about power. They're now trying to say, oh, well, the end justifies the means. So if MAS won, then you can't say this is a coup somehow. One part of me, I find this just incredibly juvenile and pathetic and dismissible. But actually, I think it's more important that they're able to kind of get away with this. So I don't know where to go with I've tied myself in a knot a bit with this question, but obviously this was a coup. But what do you think about this? Where the power, the damage that was caused by the media's response and their lies, the way it was used in this country as a yet another cudgel to try and bash Jeremy Corbyn, which is, I think, one of the ones that was least effective because too many people in this country don't know enough about Latin American politics, and all this kind of stuff. But it was disingenuous and vile, to say the least, and outright lies and cover for murder and bloodshed, to say the worst. Do you have any kind of thought on that? Or?
Yeah. When they unleashed the violence, you know, when they began to shout fraud back in October 2019, they began to shout fraud because what happens in Bolivia is this: all the cities' votes, you know, all the counting of the votes in cities come almost immediately because they are connected, there is electricity, computers, and so on. But what takes time is the rural vote, particularly in remote areas, which are not necessarily connected. And the actual luggage with the results, with the actas, which are called, you know, the paperwork, with the signatures of the officials of the various polling stations in remote areas, actually takes time because they have to travel physically by car, sometimes by horse and so on, to get to these centers where they're going to be computed by whoever officials are in charge. And then it will go all the way through to La Paz, to the capital city, to be computerized and to be counted. And because that normally takes 2 to 3 days, then that's exactly what happened on this particular occasion. You know, we have the 100% results only 2 days ago. We had 95% a few days ago. And when it came to the question of the counting, then they began to say fraud, 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 because the rural vote was delayed, was taking some time to come in. They used that excuse. They mobilized paramilitaries throughout the nation. This was very violent. It was extremely violent. People were beaten up, particularly indigenous women. They targeted indigenous women in the most disgusting fashion. They attacked several headquarters of the MAS everywhere. They attacked several National Electoral Council offices in various cities. They even burned the actual ballot boxes in many places. Not one, several. And worse, they actually target the houses of ministers, and they, you know, took over the houses of ministers, and they kidnap or they held hostages their families. Mm. And this was completely well known by all the correspondents that were there, by their hundreds, from all the outfits you want. You name one, they had correspondents there. The BBC, The Guardian, you know, anybody. And they knew exactly as I knew at the time that this was going on. They knew as well. And they failed to report this deliberately because they were under instructions, which ultimately, you know, reached all the way to Washington and the State Department. They will not report this. And many ministers were forced to actually make very terrible statements, saying that, you know, yes, of course, you know, everyone had a chromosome because this is a problem. And they were forced to say this, and they later on revealed this, because they told them that if they didn't do this, their families would be assassinated. Many houses of ministers were burned down, you know, by these thugs. They were mobilized, and it is totally clear, in my view, there were all sorts of dark forces operating, not necessarily from the military, although I'm sure sections of the military must have been involved, but certainly by the racist organizations, especially from Santa Cruz. And thousands of them were marching towards La Paz. You know, when the pressure on Evo Morales was being built up for him to resign. And one of the reasons why he resigned was because he knew that if he stayed, there would be a terrible confrontation, you know, in the capital city with hundreds, if not thousands of people dying. And then, you know, opening up the possibility of a coup d'etat. So if he, you know, there is more, but this gives you an idea of what was going on. This is a coup d'etat in everything, even in name. And they were clear, the mass and the political leaders, they said, this is a coup d'etat. There is no question about it, there was a coup d'etat. And this was orchestrated and facilitated by Luis Almagro, who was the one who initiated everything. And this was done with the State Department full participation in the internal affairs of Bolivia again. So when governments in the West, certainly the UK government and the United States and others, you know, were delighted that finally democracy is being restored and all this nonsense, is really disgusting and criminal, because the consequences of them having supported a de facto government, the result of a coup d'etat, stimulate very many other forces of right-wing nature in the region as well as elsewhere to do something similar, because they know they're going to have the support of the civilized so-called West, including the UK government, of course. Now that they pretend that everything is fine and so on, is a disgusting, cynical maneuver. And you can imagine they're going to say to Bolivia, how about, you know, discussing businesses with you on lithium, copper, and all the minerals wonderfully that you have in your country. And, you know, we cannot accept this. So I want to, you know, denounce them for being complicit in the coup d'etat that took place, and thankfully the Bolivian masses were able to restore democracy. Let's hope that they continue to support democracy as they claim they do in the months that are coming. And the reason I'm saying this is because of the following. The extreme right wing in Bolivia say they are not going to recognize the result, and they say they're going to organize to resist these results. So we'll see what the UK government does, what the United States does, and what other governments in the European Union in particular do with regard to this. I think we must remain totally vigilant and, you know, continue to support the restoration of democracy, because this is just the beginning. Because what needs to be done and undone in Bolivia is a huge amount, and we cannot leave them to themselves. Our solidarity must continue as robustly as it was, you know, given during the difficult period of the 1 year that the de facto coup d'etat government stayed in power.
Okay, so I think we're more or less done for this week with Bolivia, but as a kind of bridge into, I'm going to ask this just last question on it, as a kind of bridge into the next subjects we're going to talk about. I want to talk about, first, a kind of overall attitude towards Latin America, which famously from the United States of America especially, and its allies like Britain and much of other countries in Europe, has always been very negative. I mean, it's not controversial, it's just a fact of the matter to say. The US does coups. It's done a lot of coups in Latin America. It's supported others through much of its history, for the majority of the lifetime of many of us. In fact, in my case, for even longer than I've been alive. Do you think that in the kind of classic sense of this kind of activity, that that's not going to work anymore, like in the way that it was in the 70s and the 80s, for instance? Or do you think this is basically a ball that we can never take our eyes off?
Yeah, there are two dimensions to this. Number one, the United States is not what it used to be. I'm not disappointed by that. I'm quite delighted
that is the case.
Yeah. And in other words, you know, in the 20th century, with the exception of Cuba, when the United States wanted to overthrow a government, they just did it and got away with it. You know, there's not enough time to actually mention the number of coup d'etat, military invasions, wars of attrition, and all the rest of it that the United States organized and perpetrated in the region, leading to hundreds, and this is no exaggeration, this is not a rhetorical point, literally hundreds of thousands of people dying at the hands of the people that they paid and they trained. You know, in Central America, certainly in Chile, Argentina, and all the rest of it. In Argentina alone, 32,000 people were murdered, assassinated deliberately and systematically by the forces trained, financed, and organized by the United States, you know, with the Condor Plan and Henry Kissinger and so on. So the United States in the 21st century finds it more difficult to do so. It decided to go for a strategy of constitutional coup, that is to say, as soon as there is a crisis or a problem, and, you know, our economies depend on the exploitation of raw materials, and when the economy has a glitch or a hiccup, then obviously we suffer enormously. And that creates significant problems for the government, particularly progressive governments. And the United States immediately jumps, leaps on it and begins to organize forces. Well, it organizes forces all the time with huge amounts of money. I mean, billions and billions of dollars are spent on all kinds of NGOs, outfits of every kind, supporting the media, funding political parties, training all sorts of forces that are ready and pounds when the conditions exist. And that's the, you know, that's another form of coup, but it's a coup. And that's what the United States have been organizing in the past period. It has significant successes in Honduras. It has had significant successes, certainly, in Brazil, you know, with the impeachment of Dilma and then the imprisonment of Lula. Third, and, you know, getting Bolsonaro elected. It has successes in Argentina and a few other places, certainly in Ecuador, as a result of, in my view, the co-optation of Moreno, who is the current president, who betrayed the citizen revolution and so on. And then it has, you know, 9 or 10 military bases in Colombia just for good measure, just in case there is any need for a more robust intervention. The problem they have is this, and I think the difference with the coup d'etats in the 70s compared to now is this. In the 1970s, the defeat had a historic nature. That is to say, it would take a generation or longer to recover from coup d'etat, such as in Chile. In Chile, you know, the destruction of the Allende government and the coup d'etat there has taken Chile all this long, for, you know, more or less two generations for the left to be able to recover, and democracy is being restored very, very, very gradually. And in the case of Bolivia, you know, it took them only 1 year for the forces of democracy and progress to recover. And in the case of Brazil, although there's been a lot of damage done, the forces of the left and the social forces, the live social forces that can restore democracy and bring about, you know, progress again, actually are entire, are completely there. They haven't been destroyed. The people haven't been assassinated, although some assassinations have taken place. Nothing of the scale of Chile or Argentina or Central America in the 1980s taking place. I think that applies to Ecuador as well. We've been able to recover in Argentina quite nicely. We've been able to win back in Bolivia. I think the next one is very likely to be Brazil that recovers, because conditions do exist. I think that's what the United States is unable to do. And there are, I mean, there's much more than one can say, but there are two things I want to highlight. Number one, the United States is in serious, serious, serious economic decline. Its economy suffers from very grave structural problems, and there is no politician that I can see in the United States, Biden, Trump, or anybody else that one can envisage. Perhaps Sanders has got some answers to the problem. There is no politician that can muster a majority that actually can address seriously the problems that the United States confronts is so great. So that's number one, which obviously impairs its capacity to really, you know, offer anything to the right wing when it wins. And the reason is the consequences is the United States may win some, may make some political gains in Latin America, but is unable to consolidate them. You know, Bolivia is a case in point. So that's this one. And the second one is there is a whole new multilateral geopolitical reality emerging all over the place. Certainly China is a big giant, you know, whatever problems and whatever people may think about that. The very fact that Latin America and many other countries around the world can choose, you know, who to do business with, who to trade with, where to get your technology from, where to obtain credits from, and so on, which doesn't depend only on the United States and the IMF, gives a huge amount of space to the left when it risks, I'm going to put that in inverted commas, when it risks to actually go for structural change in the case of Latin America in our region. So it seems to me that those two things combined makes it very difficult for the United States to consolidate against, and therefore, though we can still call them a coup d'etat, they do not have the significance, you know, in terms of a structural transformation of society as they did in the 1970s. I think that's good for us, and you know, I don't want the United States to decline too fast because it will produce fascism, but I want them to decline so much that it's unable to actually do any damage to us or anybody else.
You mentioned we've got elections coming up in Chile.
Yeah, this is extraordinary. I mean, on the 18th of October 2019, I think it was on the 18th of October as well. You know, coincidence. The secondary school students decided that, you know, an increase in the fare of the public transport system in Chile, particularly of the underground, which is used very heavily, was completely unacceptable, and they decided to not pay. You know, they just jammed the machines, you know, where you actually put your card, as you do here in the London Underground, yeah. And they decided to jump over and, you know, refuse to pay because they said this is not acceptable. And that led to a massive rebellion of society. I mean, what it started with the secondary school sort of naughty, rebellious attitude, this became a national rebellion against neoliberalism. At the beginning, it was just against the fares, the increasing fares. But then it now has become massively, is grown into a total rebellion against the, you know, Chile's neoliberalism. So much so that millions have mobilized, millions, that is not exaggerated, throughout the nation. And the government in place actually is under siege, even though it's very brutal in the repression that is conducted. More than 80 people have died. I think that's the information that I have. And more than 500 people have lost or has serious eye wounds because the Minister of Interior, the person in charge of law and order, has given a specific instructions to the police. You know, this comes from France, civilized France, enlightened France, to actually fire rubber bullets on the faces of people so that you destroy their eyes. And 543 people have suffered serious, wounds in their eyes. Many of them have lost one eye, and certainly two of them have lost their eyesight completely. This is disgustingly criminal. And this was deliberate. It was done again and again and again and again, months after months, week after week, of the demonstrations that people actually continue to stage despite the conditions existed by the pandemic and despite the repression. And they force through minority progressive forces within parliament, but they managed to actually put pressure on them, the mass movement. And they won majorities. And they won majorities, and now we are going to have a plebiscite, a referendum, which is taking place today as we speak. And the referendum is going to be about setting up something like they call it a constitutional convention, which I think is going to have the status of a constituent assembly, where they're going to decide, you know, to have a new constitution. The current Chilean constitution was enacted, promulgated by Mr. Augusto Pinochet, you know, under the conditions of dictatorship. And it's a shame that although democracy was restored in Chile in 1999, democracy with inverted commas, 1990, there had been all these years of democratic government, you know, under elections where parties participate and so on, and they haven't taken the decision to actually change the constitution. And only the mass movement actually is doing it. And what the mass movement wants is not just a constitution, they want a completely new model. And they said the plebiscite is not only about the constitution, which is going to change anyway, but it's also about the economic model. In Chile, the pension system is totally privatized. And what they do is they literally take the money of people for 30 years. And when it comes to their retirement, all companies sue or take the case to the courts. This is done by many. Thousands and thousands of people actually suffer this. And they win the case. And the people whose money was taken away by these private companies for years, 30 years, 40 years in some cases, they get paid a pittance. The level of wages in Chilean terms that are paid to something like 70% of the working class are below what is expected from a, you know, robust economy as Chile. Chile is the only country in the world that the constitution allows for the private sector to actually own rivers. This is no exaggeration. The Constitution of Chile is the only country in the world that allows the private sector to own lakes, to own water, and even sections, you know, bits of the sea are owned by these companies, and so on. So you can imagine Chile is the most perfect neoliberal nightmare that you can imagine, and the people have said this is enough. All the indications are, and it's not clear exactly, you know, we cannot predict that much, but all of the indications are, certainly by talking to people over there and, you know, following developments, that the majority is going to be for changing the constitution and a constitutional convention is going to win. Now, exactly what happens after that, you know, we'll see, and we have to wait and see. Nevertheless, the Bolivian stimulus, obviously, is going to exacerbate even more the desire of people for change. The new model is going to definitely have a, you know, very strong, and this is what people are saying, a very strong publicly funded national health service, with the service being provided free of charge at the point of attention, which is, you know, more or less based on the system here, even though the tourists have tried to destroy it. The AFPs, which is the hedge funds that control the pension system, are going to have to go. And already the movement want that every single person who has been paying the pension system, you know, their money, they got already 10% back. People are delighted. You know, they were able to actually get that concession. So they're going to, you know, made public as much as possible. And one of the discussions that is going on is that the copper, which is the main export item of Chile, you know, the main revenue earner of the country. Chile is the largest producer of copper in the world. And now with the expansion of computing and so on, this is an extremely important and the price of copper, important industry. And the price of copper, obviously, is going very high. It's been gradually privatized, and they want this to be renationalized completely by the new situation. There is one problem, though, and this is what the main problem is, as I say. The movement is very spontaneous. It's organized in many thousands of ad hoc committees all over the place, all over the country. They seem to be very, understandably, very hostile to any political party, no matter what they are. And therefore, the movement has a level of spontaneity which is incredibly high, but which will produce a weakness when it comes to the question of, you know, how do you negotiate details of the constitution? How do you actually proceed to decide Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, Article 4, and so on? And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any political force that hegemonizes, you know, at least as a guide or that they will listen to, that could actually help this. And there are very good political forces on the left, and unfortunately, they are a minority. These may change quite dramatically, because when you have processes like this, you know, they I think with a tongue-in-cheek, they call the 18th of October, they call it the October Revolution. When you have processes like this, you know, things can change quite rapidly, and political forces are quite insignificant, because they get it right and they actually send the right message and all, you know, make the right proposal, they can become quite powerful forces. One example is Hugo Chavez, you know, boom, from nothing into this giant. And the second one, which I want to mention, is Rafael Correa. When he resigned as the Minister of Economics from the previous government, you know, previous to the Citizen Revolution, he stood as a potential presidential candidate with something like 2% of the vote, of the potential vote in any election, and he went from there to become the president of the country for about 12 years. So in this context of collapse of the old regime, of the ancien regime, things can change quite rapidly. I want to push the movement as far as it can go. I think they want to go there. And one very significant factor, very important factor, is the very fact that those who are leading the process, there is plenty of people, you know, from all ages participating. Women are central to this. And then the youth of women are certainly key leaders of the political process that is going on in Chile right now. And youth as a whole are the ones that are in the vanguard. They are the ones that mobilized the generation before. And those two mobilized the generation before, which is my generation, from the coup d'etat. And as a result of it, they've created an extraordinary thing. I've listened with, you know, mesmerized by some of their political discussions. I mean, the political level and the quality of their analysis is just amazing. You know, something that I never imagined that we will have in my time. You know, in my time, some of us were very politicized. We're very young, but we're very green. And we have to listen to, you know, the more experienced guys, that they don't seem to need that. So I think this is going to produce something quite interesting. And in the context of Latin America, in the context of the decline of the United States and the new emerging forces of progress on the left in Latin America, I think this will produce very good results. I don't want to say much more than that. The reason is, you know, we have to wait and see what the results are, how the various political forces are going to reorganize. So one final indication of how strong this is. There is a right-wing bastard, excuse my French again, called Joaquin Lavín, who is a very well-known right-wing politician, Pinochetista, you know, supporter of Pinochet, participated in the coup, was minister of Pinochet and minister of all the right-wing governments ever since. He has suddenly come up saying that he is a social democrat. He's a progressive. He's left-wing. He says that he supports the change of the constitution and he wants to support the, you know, life forces of society that has emerged over this crisis, and he wants to be part of it, and he wants to actually change Chile, you know, in a progressive manner, because he's realized that social democracy is the way forward, which is an indication, a very sort of cynical, manipulative way to say, bloody hell, we cannot stop them. So I think I leave people with that thought.
I meant to tell you about this earlier. I don't know if you've heard this, but there was a really cool podcast I heard the other day about Victor Jara, which I'll probably send you a link if you like. It was James Dean Bradfield, who's a musician I like, who's just done an album about him. And he was talking to lots of people about, you know, about who he was and the I mean, all stuff you already know, but it'll be interesting to hear. Apparently, Emma Thompson
Send it over.
I will, mate. Please. I will. I'll go and find it now. Emma Thompson, the writer and actor, actually wrote a screenplay about his life, but it never got made.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.trexfm.org.